The Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and I will note this meeting is taking place under House Rule 10.01. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll.
Chair Houseman?
Present.
Houseman, present. Vice Chair Howard?
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Tice is excused. Representative Agbaje? Representative Bliss?
Present.
Bliss, present. Representative Gomez?
Gomez, present.
Gomez, present. Representative Hassan?
Hassan's present.
Hassan, present. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Herr?
Present.
Herr, present. Representative Juergens? Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Farr?
Farr, present.
Farr, present. And Representative Ryer?
Ryer, present.
Ryer, present. And Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Members, the next item of business is the approval of the minutes, but I think before we move to that order of business, it's appropriate for us to say happy birthday, Representative Howard. Today is your birthday. I hope you are going to find some way to celebrate today, in spite of the fact that it's a busy work day.
Thank you, Chair Houseman. My birthday wish was to get to chair part of this committee, so I'm already going to.
There you go. Mark. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
So the next item of business is the approval of the minutes from Tuesday, February 15. Representative Howard, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I'll move the minutes.
And members, were there any corrections to the minutes? If not, if you would unmute yourself. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Members, as the author of the bill today, we are about to hear, I'm going to hand over the virtual gavel to Vice Chair Howard for the duration of the committee meeting.
Thank you, Representative Houseman. And with that, would you like to move your bill?
I will move, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 2880 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you. And members, there is an author's amendment to get the bill in the proper shape. Representative Houseman, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A1. This amendment changes the Housing Infrastructure Grant Program from using GO bonds to a general fund appropriation. Nonpartisan staff observed that this was not an allowable use of GO bonds, so we're making that change, and I would appreciate members' support. Again, nonpartisan staff has made this suggestion.
Representative Houseman has moved the A1. Members, is there any discussion? I don't see any, and so if you could unmute yourself. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. Representative Houseman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2880 is the work of the League of Minnesota Cities, and they have given it the title Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act, which focuses on a comprehensive approach to address housing issues across the housing spectrum with policy and resources that are proven to support affordability and availability of a diverse array of housing opportunities. We know that there's innovation happening at the local level to attract and support preservation and development, but local governments can't do it alone. There needs to be a robust state-local partnership if we are to address housing in a comprehensive way. The League of Minnesota Cities grounds its policies and resources in the fact that housing is local and that approaches to address housing challenges cannot be one size fits all. In its comprehensive approach, the Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act contains policies and resources grounded in four key principles. One, to address the full housing spectrum as each city is sustained by a different mix of housing, from preservation of existing affordable housing to the construction of new single family and multifamily housing. Number two, to support local innovation rather than hinder it. Three, to provide incentives instead of mandates to address affordability and availability. And finally, to provide community-specific solutions throughout Minnesota that are sensitive to the unique housing needs of communities. You will notice some familiar funding provisions in the bill that this committee has discussed previously that have been proven to address housing challenges. And unlike other proposals, hopefully guarantee affordability. These include capital investment resources for housing, additional general fund appropriations for naturally occurring affordable housing, and local housing trust funds, state matching grants, as well as some new provisions that cities believe will help address housing at the local level in a meaningful way, such as additional flexibility for existing local financing tools, grants for housing-related infrastructure to incentivize affordable development, and policy to address investor purchasing of homes. Here to walk through the bill is Daniel Lightfoot, who is Intergovernmental Relations Representative with the League of Minnesota Cities.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities, representing the collective interests of 837 member cities across the state of Minnesota. On behalf of the League, we appreciate Chair Hausman for carrying this bill and for the opportunity to have a conversation today on House File 2880, the Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act. As Chair Hausman noted, the Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act provides policy and resources that provide what we believe is a multifaceted approach at addressing housing challenges that are unique to various regions and communities across the state. From the outset, I will note that the bill does have a number of sections. It is a large bill, and Chair Hausman did note that some of the provisions will be familiar and some are new. And we also note that the dollar amounts in this bill are substantial. And we believe that the state has a continued role to play in assisting local units of government in bending the cost curve for affordable housing preservation and affordable housing construction as well. And so what I'd like to do is walk through the provisions of the bill. I won't pretend to do it as well as your incredible staff that is helping the committee, but I do wanna give a shout out to Justin Cope and Mary Mullen and Chelsea Griffin as well, who helped us extensively on this bill as we worked through the provisions. And then after walking through the bill, I'd like to turn it over to two city testifiers that can provide a more specific city perspective, Todd Peterson with the City of Roseau and Sherry Schoquist with the City of Golden Valley. Section one of the bill establishes a matching program to cities up to 50% of capital costs of public infrastructure necessary for workforce housing. As you'll hear from Todd Peterson from the City of Roseau, one of the biggest barriers to attracting development to greater Minnesota isn't the availability of land. They have a lot of that. It's the cost of public infrastructure, such as water, sewer connections, streets necessary to support new housing development. And while many cities are trying to provide public resources to assist developers with this cost in greater Minnesota, this provision, as well as the provision in Section 18 of the bill, will help cities continue to make lots ready for new development. And as I said, bend the cost curve for that new development so that new housing can be affordable to a local workforce. Section two of the bill is a new provision that we worked on, and it's the creation of a real estate excise tax. It creates a real estate excise tax on the sale of real property classified as 1A when the buyer is a corporate entity that owns four or more class 1A non-homesteaded residential properties and is not a nonprofit or community land trust. The graduated tax structure is based off of Washington State's program. And really, this is intended to deter bulk investor purchasing of single-family owner-occupied housing and provide additional revenue to address housing needs while preserving homeownership opportunities. Last year, we know that investors bought nearly 1 in 7 homes sold in America's top metropolitan areas. And often this was disproportionately in lower income areas and areas with high populations of residents of color. For example, in Atlanta, a quarter of all homes sold last year were purchased by investors. That trend isn't as severe in Minnesota, but we have seen some alarming trends in the metro area and a doubling in the past 15 years of single family homes owned by investors. We thought long and hard about this provision, and certainly it is a work in progress to provide that balance between small landlords and also trying to deter large corporate investor purchases of homes, sometimes whole blocks or parts of entire neighborhoods that are being purchased and transitioned into single family rental. Section 3 of the bill is the Housing Redevelopment Authority ability to impose a mortgage registry and deed tax. And this just allows a city or county with an HRA to impose a mortgage registry tax or deed tax at a 0.0001 rate. And we know that HRAs across the state are trying to innovate with limited resources. And the option to impose a small tax over time will further help HRAs if they so choose to raise additional revenue that can be reinvested back into community housing goals. Sections 4 to 6 will be familiar to the committee. Their housing infrastructure bond provisions, authorization of 400 million housing infrastructure bonds, as well as language from last session that's also been reintroduced this session to extend eligibility for some deeper affordable projects in that 30 to 50% AMI level and have preference for those projects. One of the big challenges in cities that are focused on attracting affordable development is figuring out how to bend the cost curve enough to get to that deeper affordability level. We know that HIBs are a proven resource to assist with the construction, acquisition, rehabilitation of that qualified housing. We also know that, as the commissioner was on here a couple of weeks ago, that 3 out of every 4 applicants don't receive funding from this resource and others at Minnesota Housing due to lack of resources. Section 7 of the bill is a new program as well, is a housing cost reduction incentive program. It provides matching grants to cities that provide fee waivers or establish inclusionary housing programs to attract affordable housing development. As Chair Hausman noted, cities are continuing to innovate at the local level and provide incentives to developers in exchange to helping to address community housing goals, which often include affordability. The framework for the Housing Cost Reduction Incentive Program, we believe, would strengthen that state-local partnership in incentivizing further that local innovation for guaranteed affordability. Sections 8 and 9, my colleague Todd Peterson will talk a little bit more about, but provide some clear statutory authority for HRAs to actually construct housing in some cases. Oftentimes, growing cities are trying to attract new development to support an expanding workforce, but the market just isn't responding in building out in areas in greater Minnesota. And cities like Roseau and others have considered and in some cases have implemented projects to actually do it themselves when the market won't respond. Section 10 is tax increment financing provisions, provides some expansion to really a critical local tool that is very important and used by hundreds of cities across the state and is often a key difference in getting projects across the finish line and a way for local units of government to finance affordable housing opportunities and provide some assistance directly to developers. It does provide statewide statutory authority for cities to transfer unobligated increment to their local housing trust funds as well. Section 11 is also a new program, new policy. And I'll let my colleague Sherry Shoquist talk a little bit more about this, but it authorizes the city by ordinance to establish a relocation assistance program for displaced tenants. We know that more and more cities are trying to innovate through policy to address tenant displacement in certain circumstances, and this is especially important to reduce the impact of and mitigate displacement to improve housing stability. Section 12 is a to-be-determined amount appropriation for the Housing Cost Reduction Incentive Program. We're trying to have conversations on what the scale of that program should look like, and certainly are interested in working with members of the committee to make that determination. Section 13 is also familiar language to the committee, provides some additional resources for the Challenge Fund Grant Program. This is one of Minnesota Housing's most flexible programs. Around 39 awards, I believe, are made per year to support locally identified housing needs that support economic development. And Section 13 provides some additional funding for this critical program that generally is oversubscribed. Section 14 is the other housing infrastructure grant program that would be statewide. This was a bill that was introduced last session that would allow any city to access some state grant matching funds for the provision of housing infrastructure. Section 15 is familiar language as well. That was led by Vice Chair Howard and members of the committee to provide resources for naturally occurring affordable housing preservation. We know that to address the full housing spectrum, policy and resources have to focus on preservation, which is especially important, as you'll hear, in built-out cities like Golden Valley, which Sherry will discuss. Section 16 is $100 million in general obligation bonds for public housing rehabilitation. This is a crucial resource to assist federally assisted public housing that have hundreds of millions of dollars in backlog repairs. There are some cities in this state that they themselves in one city have almost, if not more than $100 million in backlog. And these are repairs that aren't just, windows. These are sometimes life safety repairs, boilers and things like elevators, things like that. And so we're hoping for some additional capital investment resources there. Section 17 of the bill was another initiative that was spearheaded by Vice Chair Howard in the provision of local housing trust fund state matching grants. It appropriates $10 million from the general fund to Minnesota Housing to provide matching grants to local units of government that choose to commit non-state resources to a trust fund. We did get, there was an appropriation of $1 million last session for the provision of state matching grants. We're looking forward to seeing how that is deployed. We know that from Alexandria to Red Wing, we've seen local housing trust funds deployed as flexible resources that meet local needs. This could include things like down payment assistance for first-time home buyers. We've also seen them deployed for gap financing to try to bridge the gap for some new construction to ensure affordability. We also know that on average, $6 in additional public and private funds are leveraged for every dollar of non-state public revenue that's invested in a trust fund. And some cities that have looked into establishing a trust fund are just kind of waiting to get the seed capital needed to make that trust fund a meaningful investment. And also are doing so with limited resources and have to weigh all kinds of different city priorities. So those matching grants would really be critical to bolster existing trust funds and also see more trust funds created across the state. And then lastly is the Housing Infrastructure Grant Pilot Program. And this was the appropriation that was referenced in the author's amendment to make that a general fund expenditure rather than bonding. So with that, Mr. Chair, you've heard enough of my voice probably this morning already. Appreciate the ability to and the opportunity to walk through this bill. As I said, it is a robust effort that we believe is comprehensive and can address the full housing spectrum that cities have to be sensitive to support a diverse array of housing stock that meets their residents' needs, rather than just focusing on one aspect of the housing spectrum. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Todd Peterson with the City of Roseau.
Thank you, Mr. Lightfoot. Mr. Peterson, you're up next. Would you say your name for the committee? And we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Peterson, and I serve as Community Development Coordinator for the City of Roseau, Minnesota. For those of you who haven't had the pleasure of visiting Roseau, we are a growing city just south of the Canadian border with a population of 2,700. On behalf of the city, I'd like to thank Chair Hausman for offering this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and provide you with the greater Minnesota city perspective on House File 2880. And the importance of addressing the full housing spectrum and provide community-specific housing solutions to assist greater Minnesota cities like Roseau in addressing our unique housing needs. Despite the focus on housing needs in the Twin Cities and the discussion of the red hot market there, the City of Roseau and many of our greater Minnesota colleagues struggle to attract any type of development whatsoever. That's not for lack of demand, which is problematic when Polaris wants to bring new jobs to Roseau, but nobody will build housing. Today, Polaris alone has a need for over 100 new employees at its Roseau facility. While it has had success in recruiting persons from across the country, it is difficult to retain these employees due to a lack of affordable housing or available housing. Polaris provides 30 days of temporary housing assistance through hotel vouchers and company-owned transitional housing. But turnover after the first month is high for any employees who cannot obtain permanent housing solutions. The source of our housing problem is threefold. First, developers will consistently get higher rates of return in the metropolitan areas with considerable lower risk than they would in Greater Minnesota, where construction generally appraises lower than the raw construction costs. For example, the city of Roseau is developing a 37-unit apartment complex today that will cost $6.8 million to build, yet it will only appraise at a value of $5 million. That leaves a $1.8 million value gap that we must somehow fill. Second, despite our city's efforts to pull every lever we can to attract development, including tax abatements, TIF, low or no-cost city-supplied land, developers rarely look at the smaller growing communities like ours to develop. The rate of return is simply too low, and the developers have a difficult time reaching any type of economies of scale needed to make projects feasible due to our small populations in our region. Finally, the vast majority of workers in manufacturing sectors ironically make too much to qualify for most affordable housing programs offered to the state. However, they do not earn enough to generate private development of new market housing. In Roseau County, for every household eligible for an affordable income-restricted housing unit, there are four households in need of a market-rate workforce unit. These proportions do not sync with the typical 60-40 affordable housing programs offered through Minnesota Housing. Thus, our communities overbuild affordable units, which tend to sit empty, while we continue to lack market-rate units, which have long waiting lists. Furthermore, while we have an abundance of green space to develop, what is challenging is addressing the infrastructure needs for new development, which can often be costly to scale up to accommodate new housing units. Again, because of our inability to support large-scale projects, we cannot drive the price of infrastructure down to levels that are affordable to working families. In 2021, the city of Roseau created a new subdivision in 17 lots. The cost to develop each lot was $46,500, with only $2,300 of that representing land cost. The cost to develop residential lots have increased exponentially in recent years, from when the average lot in Roseau could be purchased for around $15,000 to $20,000 for lot and infrastructure. And those costs generally were about 10 to 15% of the total housing development cost. Today, those costs have more than doubled, adding over 20% to the total housing development costs for a single family unit. We have heard that the private market will take care of building housing, but that's not what's happening in Greater Minnesota. Private developers simply cannot make any money in our market, and no fully private housing venture has occurred in Roseau in over 30 years. Even the city of Roseau, which has increasingly stepped in to take over housing development, has had to wrestle with how much it can reasonably afford to lose on housing projects in order to provide much needed housing for our industry. What we need are additional tools and resources that can support our local efforts to address our unique housing needs. And when the market fails to bring needed development, and there are several provisions of the Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act that will do just that. I'd like to focus on a few sections of the bill that we believe will assist Greater Minnesota in providing community-specific assistance and flexibilities to our local housing needs. First, sections 1 and 18 of the bill provide resources to cities to address the infrastructure needs to support new development. This includes the critical infrastructure needed to support development such as water, sewer, and streets that are often a huge barrier to attracting development in Greater Minnesota. While cities in Greater Minnesota often stretch to foot the bill for infrastructure as a way to attract new development, our resources are finite, and these sections would provide matching grants funds to assist in that effort. The state has similar existing programs for business infrastructure, and it's important that we also provide resources for housing infrastructure to support those businesses. For example, the city of Roseau invested $1.1 million in housing in 2021 to create a 37 rental housing units and to develop 17 single-family residential lots. That represent over 100% of our city's annual tax levy. While housing is extremely important, that kind of annual expenditure is not sustainable for a community of our size and taxing power. Second, sections 8 and 9 would provide a clear path for an HRA and EDA to develop single and multifamily workforce housing projects. This is a critical flexibility for a city like Roseau that is trying to address workforce housing needs when the private market will not. As I mentioned earlier, the city of Roseau and its development arm, the EDA, sought to get involved in the development of a rental housing project for workforce housing in absence of a private developer willing to take on the project. However, we found no statutory authority to engage in this endeavor. This required the EDA to use an awkward redevelopment workaround in order for us to even undertake the project. Lastly, flexible resources like the Local Housing Trust Fund state matching grants would help bridge the gap for smaller cash-strapped communities like Roseau to deploy more dedicated public resources to address our critical housing needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Next up, testifying, we have Cherry Schoquist from Golden Valley. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Schoquist, and I serve as the Housing and Economic Development Manager with the City of Golden Valley. Thank you to Chair Houseman for authoring the Comprehensive Housing Spectrum Act. I'm here to provide a metro area city perspective on House File 2880 and the importance of the bill's provisions for a city like Golden Valley to address our local housing needs across the housing spectrum. Golden Valley, like every city across the state, is sustained by a different mix of housing stock, which includes market rate and affordable single and multifamily housing, in addition to publicly subsidized housing for individuals, families with children, seniors, people with disabilities, and people who are homeless and unsheltered. While the emphasis of recent conversation in committee and in the media is focused on new single family market rate subdivisions, Golden Valley as a built out city is very focused on the preservation of our existing housing stock, as well as redevelopment to provide more housing opportunity in our community. Golden Valley has nearly 3,000 of what we would consider to be naturally occurring affordable single family homes or pre-1950 housing, and 660 units of naturally occurring affordable housing multifamily rental units. Our city has deployed a myriad of tools and resources at the local level to support preservation and to mitigate the displacement of residents, but we continually need a more robust state-level partnership to address these issues. We have met individually with a majority of the owners of our multifamily naturally occurring affordable housing properties in Golden Valley, and they are committed to providing quality NOAA properties and units in the community. However, our programs such as the 4D tax abatement program, thank you for raising the level, and our ability to provide housing for rehab not provide enough of a benefit for property owners to commit to long-term affordability. We're very concerned that if one of these properties enters the market, even with our resources, including our bond authority and our ability to partner with nonprofit organizations like Aon and Common Bond, who have taken a leading role in NOAA preservation across the state, that we still won't have the resources and perhaps most importantly, the time to be successful in the national competition to acquire NOAA properties, not for preservation, but most often for conversion to market rate units, which displaces tenants and the workforce of our communities. Not to mention that the majority of low to moderate income renters in our communities are Black, Indigenous, and people of color who are disproportionately impacted by the loss of these NOAA units. Local governments and nonprofit housing organizations are and will do all the work in preparation to be competitive if a NOAA property enters the market. However, local government is not in the position to compete with investors that have cash in hand. please consider a statewide NOAA fund for preservation, something perhaps similar to the Office and Management and Budget process for bonding that has a much quicker turnaround. We're really looking for something more like a two-week commitment process with due diligence to occur after that original commitment. As a city with housing needs, they're much different than a city like the city of Roseau or a less built city in the greater metro area. It is critical that a comprehensive approach to addressing housing is sensitive to those differences. House File 2880 is a balanced approach that supports cities trying to attract new development and would greatly assist cities like Golden Valley that are focused on preserving the affordable opportunities we have. In addition to NOAA preservation, we are actively working to attract mixed income housing developments and new light industrial and commercial businesses to our city for the benefit of our region as a whole. We need mixed income workforce housing to attract and retain employers and employees. I'd like to focus on a few sections of the bill that will assist many built out metro area cities that are focused on redevelopment and preservation and the expansion of tools and resources to meet our locally identified housing needs. First, additional resources for preservation are critical. We know the most cost-effective way to provide affordable housing opportunities in a community like Golden Valley is to preserve the housing we already have. The provision of additional capital investment resources for housing authorized in the bill, including housing infrastructure bonds and general obligation bonds that can be utilized for preservation are key. But the state can and should do more to address preservation. Section 15 contains a crucial provision for Golden Valley. The inclusion of $50 million in dedicated funding for naturally occurring affordable housing will help support local efforts for NOAA preservation. While in the city of Golden Valley, we are exploring the establishment of a local housing trust fund, our HRA continues to innovate with extremely limited resources. We have struggled to utilize limited levy resources to create our local housing trust fund and to provide a dedicated and flexible local resource that could be used for down payment assistance, preservation efforts, and other incentives for new affordable housing development. The $10 million appropriation in Section 17 of the bill could provide the seed funding that we need to launch our local affordable housing trust fund, and that would prove to be a meaningful resource in support of home ownership and preservation in our community. While Golden Valley hasn't been impacted as much as our neighboring inner suburbs have, the trend in corporate investor purchasing of single family homes that are then transitioned into single family rental is very concerning. This removes homeownership opportunities in our communities. We appreciate the excise tax provision in Section 2 that provides the foundation for a discussion on how the state could assist in responding to this trend so that we can preserve home ownership opportunities in our community for all. A new provision that could be very helpful to cities like Golden Valley and cities across the state is Section 7's provision of a housing cost reduction incentive program. While we don't control market forces, cities often provide assistance to developers to incentivize affordable development. Importantly, the provision of these local public resources are contingent on the achievement of a community housing goal, which is often affordability. But the absence of reduction of these fees does not mean the absence of a cost to the city and a tax base. For example, if the HRA provides a waiver of a park dedication fee as an incentive to a mixed income housing development, it is actually either a repayment to the Parks and Rec Department or a reimbursement to the developer that both come out of the HRA's existing funding. Section 7 would provide a state incentive to bolster these local innovations that would be proven to result in deeper affordability. The provision in Section 11 could provide a clear statutory path for a city to require reasonable relocation assistance for displaced tenants is something the City of Golden Valley has been working on for the past few years. We have a tenant protection ordinance in place and are working to develop further our communication and enforcement mechanisms. Section 11 is modeled after the provisions already required of housing operating under the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Uniform Relocation Assistance Standards and seeks to provide uniform, fair, and equitable treatment of residents who are displaced as a result of a sale, substantial rehabilitation, or change of use. Section 11 would benefit both tenants and new property owners by providing clarity and stability. Lastly, we know that some of these provisions will be discussed further in the tax committee, but the added flexibility for tax increment finance usage for housing would be extremely helpful to Golden Valley. The ability to transfer unobligated increment to a local housing trust fund would provide additional flexible resources that a city like Golden Valley could deploy for a variety of ways. TIF is most often the number one local tool that developers request, and greater flexibility to do more with that resource for housing would be a welcome change that would help the city do more at the local level. When a development requests TIF and does not partner that with other resources available at the state level, at the Metropolitan Council or the county level, we are able to bring affordable housing units online much more quickly than a project that needs additional sources of funding. And with the affordable housing crisis being what it is in the metro region today, TIF is one of our most used and best used financing mechanisms to incentivize both affordable and mixed use developments. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle Quist Henderson. I see Representative Bliss, your hand is raised. I'm wondering, we have two more testifiers. Would you be okay with waiting till we finish our testifiers before asking a question?
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks, Representative. Next, we have Mr. Egger from the Minnesota Realtors.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I could, you might want to consider, because we only have four testifiers, taking the questions because they might relate to the particular testifier, which is might be very different from the next one.
So I'm waiting to the end, Madam Chair.
Okay, it sounded like Representative Bliss said he was comfortable waiting. So we will go to Mr. Egger.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Egger, and I am Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. We're a statewide trade association with a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals, working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding our concerns with a few provisions in the bill. Section 2 of the bill creates a new real estate excise tax on certain corporate entity buyers when they purchase residential property. Our members work with buyers every day that find the current market particularly challenging and this due to the severe lack of homes for sale. In December, there were only 7,121 homes for sale statewide. For context, in December of 2019, there were around 15,600 homes for sale. And if you look back to December 2012, there were over 36,000. Enacting a new real estate excise tax on certain buyers would make purchasing properties more expensive for some, but it does not address the most pressing problem. There are not enough homes on the market, and we're not building enough homes, particularly starter homes, to meet both current and future demand. Also, often the ability to collect data runs ahead of the ability to understand all the potential unintended consequences of policy actions like this proposed excise tax. What is clear is if Minnesota does not start to dramatically increase the number of homes available, existing and new, to better balance supply and demand, there will continue to be an incentive for investment in housing. In other words, participants in markets react rationally to market conditions. The best way to minimize the role of investors in the market is to increase the supply of housing. Regarding Section 3 of the bill, Minnesota Realtors opposes policies that would increase the cost of housing, which this provision does by creating new mortgage registry and deed taxes authority for cities and counties. These new taxes would be on top of the existing and regressive mortgage registry and deed taxes. In fiscal year 2021 alone, over $427 million in mortgage registry and deed taxes was collected, and this proposal would add to that burden. There are also recording fees associated with these taxes, which I won't get into this morning. I'm sure there'll be a discussion in tax committee that will get into more of that detail. Revenue generated by mortgage registry and deed taxes is volatile, and the number of transactions is also not uniform across the state. For example, in 2021, there were just under 23,000 closed sales in Hennepin County, while in Dakota County, there were 8,000, and in Norman County, there were only 12. The expansion of mortgage registry and deed taxes proposed in this bill would add yet another cost to housing at a time when we think an effort should be made to reduce costs. And finally, Section 11 provides cities with new authority to create by ordinance a requirement that a property owner provide relocation assistance to all tenants of affordable housing units as defined in the bill for a variety of circumstances. Requiring property owners to provide relocation assistance would be costly and may result in unintended consequences, such as rent increases to cover the potential liability of having to provide relocation assistance, and perhaps depressing new investment in affordable housing units. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Egger. And our last testifier is Kyle Burnt. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kyle Burnt. I am the Director of Public Policy at the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, known as MHA. MHA is an industry nonprofit representing 1,800 members, 300,000 rental housing units in the state. I'm here today to respectfully raise our concerns with House File 2880. I want to echo kind of what Mr. Egger said there on their concerns of Minnesota realtors on the excise tax on property. We share their concerns and additionally highlight that this type of taxation could reduce the rental housing supply, or it could also raise rents to adjust to the new housing costs that could be associated with it. We are also concerned about the language in the proposal on relocation expenses. The language in the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 49, Sections 24.201 to 0.209, I think is what it is in the bill, is intended for federal subsidized programs. The proposal would look to enact these same requirements on housing, which may or may not receive some sort of state or federal subsidy. If enacted, this could have an unintended negative consequence, as Mr. Egger had already mentioned, with the naturally occurring affordable housing stock and new development, but also with the applicability of affordable housing being loosely defined on this, it could create an incentive for operators to look to raise rents or some other option to try to get over that 50% AMI, or try to understand exactly what that is. It could create some confusion and changes in the market that could be a negative consequence of this sort of proposal. Additionally, MHA remains seriously concerned about the new rent control policy being implemented in St. Paul. St. Paul has the most restrictive rent control policy in the country, and these sort of relocation costs may negatively impact the viability of a rental unit in that city. While we appreciate the approach of some of the proposal in its attempt to subsidize housing development and pay for some local housing fees, we are deeply concerned that some of these efforts are done at the expense of other housing options. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the time to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Burnt. That is all the folks I had on our list to testify. I'd like to just turn it back to Representative Hausman and see if you had any comments before we open it up for questions to members.
I think we're ready to go to questions, Mr. Chair.
Then up first, Representative Bliss.
Chair, I want to thank the last two testifiers. They covered a lot of what I wanted to cover. I did want to, however, make sure you can see my beautiful face here. There we go. I find it, this bill, when I talked to the people yesterday on this bill, it discussed a lot of the bonds and helping with infrastructure for the cities. And I thought, hey, that's a great idea. This bill doesn't sound that bad. You dig into it a little bit, and these real estate taxes and excise taxes and deed taxes. Madam Chair, I'm wondering, how do we plan on increasing availability of rental properties if we penalize the people that are doing it? Now, I understand that you know, that we've had, there's some news lately, our wonderful attorney general has filed suit against a provider who has, I don't know the details of the case, but it does sound like there's some legitimate issues there. You know, instead of penalizing bad property owners, once again, we take this big, you know, state-sized hammer and whack the head of the people that are actually providing housing. You know, again, when I first came to this committee, I really thought, you know, we have a good opportunity here to work with the housing providers and find out what the need is and find out how we as a state or legislative body can assist them in providing the housing that's needed. And I understand, again, that there are bad people out there and bad companies, and we need to hold those people accountable. But we don't need a state-sized hammer to whack the heads of these people. So, Madam Chair, I was excited to hear this bill, and I'm very disappointed to see Section 2 and Section 3 in there. I understand, you know, that this bill is going to be laid over. I would hope that people consider Section 2 and Section 3 and the negative impact it can have on availability of rental housing in the state. That's my comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Bliss. Representative Hausman, did you want to?
Yes, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I'll speak specifically to the excise tax, and perhaps Mr. Lightfoot would want to speak to the other tax, because that's more the city piece. But frankly, the excise tax is designed to save the very houses that people could afford to buy, large numbers of them in some communities, to save them from out-of-state investors who then pay cash for the houses and convert them to rental. And all of that opportunity for homeownership is lost for people in the neighborhood. So that's a tool intended to solve a problem to save naturally occurring affordable housing and affordable housing. This bill is going to be re-referred to the tax committee, and the tax portions will be discussed there. I know Senator Dietzick is working on some other solutions to that particular problem. My guess is that the tax committee will hear all of the approaches, and then because Representative Marquardt and Representative Joachim are the experts, they'll make some judgments about that. But my understanding is that when we re-refer it to tax committee for those to be discussed, that our advice to them is then the bill will be held over there. Mr. Lightfoot, I don't know if you want to speak to the other one.
Oh. Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Bliss, I appreciate your comments and thanks for the conversation yesterday. What we tried to do in this bill is provide a comprehensive approach and come to the table with some ideas and policy proposals that would address the entire spectrum of housing. In terms of Section 3, and I appreciate the Chair's comments on Section 2, and I will say for both sections, we know that these are a work in progress. We thought long and hard about how to address the concerning trend of corporate investor purchases of single family housing stock. And I can't stress enough that when you look at the data, where this is happening is generally lower income neighborhoods that have a high population of homeowners of color. And so we're trying to figure out what the state role could be in mitigating that impact, that's removing single family home ownership opportunities for Minnesotans. In terms of Section 3, you heard from Sherry and the limitations that city HRAs and EDAs have with their existing levy authority. And what we tried to figure out is, you know, was there some additional way to provide some minuscule additional support by way of a mortgage registry and deed tax? I mean, 0.0001 is 1/10,000th of a percent. So, I have a liberal arts degree, so you might have to check my math on this, but on a $500,000 mortgage, you're talking somewhere around 50 cents. So over time, that could be a helpful resource. But again, these two sections are both works in progress. I appreciate your comments. I appreciate the testifiers as well. We are more than happy to work with stakeholders to try to hone these provisions and see if we can get at some additional resources. But the bottom line is we want to come to the table with a whole host of ideas that we think will help efforts address the housing spectrum.
Representative Bliss, did you have a brief follow-up, or is that...
You know, I guess just one little one. I hope I don't step on Representative Farr's question here, but I also noticed that you cut out nonprofits in this, so any large nonprofit can come in there and do it, and you know, the state government picking winners and losers, and I know it's a tax issue, and I'm just real disappointed that this was put in there to begin with. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Bliss. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hausman, for bringing this bill. I appreciate all the work that's been done on it. Mr. Lightfoot, that 0.001 is $500 on that $500,000 mortgage. Current mortgage registration tax is $2.30 per thousand. We're adding almost 50% to that. So that's part of my concern. Increasing costs, the cost of housing seems to fly counter to us working on providing affordable housing. And so it's a concern of mine. I take issue with both the MRT and deed tax and the excise tax. If we're trying to protect what we say we are in the excise tax, then why are we taxing $500,000 homes and beyond? I'm concerned with that. But I'll just end with, I understand the problem. I appreciate the comments from the city of Roseau, because in my district, that's your comments are very, very similar to what's going on out there. So there's a need to continue the work here. I appreciate the work that's been done, but there's a few pieces of this I just can't wrap my arms around. And so therefore, at this point, I'll be a no. Thanks, Chair.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me? My audio has been like weird lately. We're good. Okay, thank you. Thank you. So I just wanted to say a couple things. First of all is, you know, related kind of to something that I said in committee last time we met, which is that when there's like a corporation that's paying their employees less than they need to like provide for the basics, like a home, and they have, you know, I don't know, I just did a Google search when they're like pulling down multi-million dollar profits, when they have many, many, you know, top level executives who are receiving multi-million dollar compensation packages. Like, that's a fundamental problem with that business model that government subsidy cannot like substitute for companies actually like paying their workers a living wage, like a wage on which they can like support their family, which includes providing a home. And so, you know, I'm sort of like a little uncomfortable with that kind of continued advocacy for us to step into that, as the government, to step into that place where you want to talk about a market failure. Like, that is a market failure. That means that like that this company is not paying their workers enough to be able to retain them. And like, maybe they need to pay their workers more. I don't know. Again, also not an economist. The other thing is like, you can call predatory out of state corporate house flippers, whatever you want. You can call them, you know, generous housing providers, but like, we see this dynamic happening all over our state, all over our community, all over the country, is sort of like big corporations coming in, snapping up affordable housing, deferring maintenance. That's like what's related to the lawsuit that the Attorney General filed is, you know, really a lot of these companies are not maintaining the basic living standards for the residents who are living in their properties, that they really, their business model is based on deferring as much maintenance as possible and just sucking as much profit as possible out of housing, regardless of the impact on human beings. And so I don't care what you call them, that is a practice that I believe that we have an obligation to make policy interventions to avoid where we can. The idea that a $500 tax, even if that's the number on a $500,000 transaction, would like have any impact on whether somebody decides to buy a house or doesn't decide to buy a house just doesn't add up for me. Admittedly, I've never spent $500,000 on something, so maybe my calculus would be different if I had that kind of those kind of resources at my disposal. Maybe that's how rich people stay rich, but I can't see how that would influence somebody's decision one way or the other. And then finally, I guess I have a question for Mr. Lightfoot, and you know, this is going to be kind of in a different direction, but you know, I worked at the city of Minneapolis for many years, and they passed a new comprehensive plan, which we have to do, I think every 20 years, like you file them with the Metropolitan Council, and there were broad swaths of our city and of almost every major city, every city, I think everywhere, where only single family homes are allowed. And this is, the reason for this is rooted in racism and classism. If you go back and look at why exclusionary zoning exists, it was to keep people out of neighborhoods. It was to say, we don't want multi-unit housing here. We don't want sort of undesirable lower income people in our community. And when you see conversations take place today in 2022 about housing density and single family zoning, you see kind of these same interesting, like, and, you know, classist and racist, exclusionary NIMBY kind of arguments come up. And, you know, admittedly, I've only seen this play out in the press, right? But I kind of don't exactly buy that, you know, the only, like, if we just got rid of all housing regulation, housing would magically be affordable for everybody. I don't think that's true. I do, however, think that having communities all over the place where you cannot build a duplex by right, and you have to go and get an exemption to build a duplex, when you can't build a 4 or 6 or 12 unit apartment on a lot that is like an appropriate size for that by right, and you have to go and go through an appeals process, that, you know, I believe that there needs to be a statewide approach to exclusionary zoning. And I'm concerned about some of the messages that I've seen, again, in the press from cities about, like, sort of the sanctity of maintaining local control for all, you know, zoning and land use issues. Because if Minneapolis was any indication, having localities try to deal with exclusionary single family zoning issues is incredibly difficult politically. And so I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that. My understanding, again, like, you know, I know some things and don't know many other things, but I mean, my understanding, right, is that exclusionary single family zoning is really puts a damper on our ability to develop the mix of housing options that we need to kind of meet people's needs. And, you know, I work in homelessness, and increasingly it's like we need other models. We need single room occupancy residences. We need, you know, we need to be able to build more housing for more people. So I wonder if you can just talk about that. I'm curious about how that conversation's been playing out with your members, and if you're ready to, like, to make moves on that too, and not just a bunch of investment, which, you know, I agree with, but also saying, like, no, we're going to hold you to some standards to actually, like, not give in to a model that just, like, encourages building endless McMansions, which are, you know, don't house enough people for the land that they're on, which are environmentally kind of difficult, but, like, you know, that we can have the mix of options that folks need. So sorry that was so long.
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez, I appreciate those comments. And just from the outset, the comments on kind of the corporate dynamics in terms of pay, I think is a really good observation. But I think in the areas of Greater Minnesota, employers paying a good wage, even if they increase those wages, the market dynamics out there is what's preventing those opportunities. And, you know, you could be making as high as 200-300% average median income and still not have the availability of those resources. So I think it's important for us to also be sensitive from a policy and resource perspective on the differences of those markets. And I really do appreciate your thoughtfulness on the discussion regarding inclusion in our communities. We are seeing cities across the state really dive into this subject. Sherry Shoquist can talk to you about Golden Valley's efforts with the Just Deeds Project to discharge racial covenants. You know, the city of Bloomington can talk to you about their inclusionary zoning ordinances and how they're trying to work with developers to try and create policy that guarantees affordability. And you make a great point, you know, even if there was there is density, that does not always mean affordability. And I think that's where part of the struggle is we have examples in some cities that have a teardown of a single family property. Through a process, there's some added density that's available to that lot. It gets subdivided. A duplex goes up and it's $800,000 per side of the duplex. So I think the challenge with some of the kind of the statewide approaches to zoning is each city is very different in their needs and their housing stock and what can support their residents. If those conversations are happening without a notion of how we guarantee that affordability, I fear that density does not guarantee affordability at all. Additionally, greater Minnesota cities have a very different infrastructure capability than other cities do. And so sort of a statewide approach to adding density doesn't factor in some of the sensitivities for a smaller community that may not have the ability to at a local level support that level of density. So we're continuing to have these conversations with members. I think you are seeing a lot at the local level to provide some additional options. And I think hear community input at the local level, which is so important. I fear that taking that ability at the local level away from a community removes that ability to have that community discourse and figure out those specific locally identified housing needs. But I really appreciate your comments, and we're going to continue to be engaged in that conversation.
Representative Gomez, do you have any follow-up?
No, I'm good. Thank you. I appreciate the response.
I don't see any other hands. I did have a question, a comment and a question. I wanted to thank Representative Hausman and the League for putting a really thoughtful bill together. And to me, the key word is comprehensive. As I've said a number of times, we need a yes and approach to our housing crisis that needs significant investments across the continuum of housing. And in particular, I think when you look at investments versus policy, I think investments are what's most needed. We will not be able to build and preserve the amount of housing that we have unless we make significant public investments. And there's huge public investments in this bill, and I appreciate that. But if we are truly talking about comprehensively addressing our affordable housing crisis, as Representative Gomez said, we do have to look at zoning and land use practices. And my question is, it seems like a lot of this proposal provides carrots or incentives to communities that want to lead, that want to innovate. And we heard from some of those today. But what about the communities that aren't innovating? What about the communities that are using exclusionary zoning practices to deny Minnesotans the types of housing and the types of density that frankly is required to create more supply because we have the nation's worst housing shortage? And so how does this proposal respond to cities that left to their own devices are not meeting the moment to provide housing that Minnesotans need? Mr. Lightfoot.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Howard, Madam Chair, I appreciate the question. And I think our goal here is to provide policies and resources that that enable a city at the local level to address those needs locally. I think if we want to avoid is treating each city the exact same in those policies. You heard the vast differences of where Roseau is at in terms of their housing needs as to where Golden Valley is at. And so I think we have to be very sensitive of how we address that from a statewide policy perspective when it comes to longstanding city ability to create zoning and land use policies that address their individual housing needs. Density is an important conversation, but it looks different in each community. And so our goal is to work with the legislature to figure out how do we continue to allow that innovation at the local level that is happening all over the state to continue to flourish and address some of these challenges without creating a statewide mechanism that treats all of our 854 plus cities the exact same.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Lightfoot. And, you know, I think there's a lot of folks that want to keep that conversation going. And back to the overall arching premise of this bill to be comprehensive, I think that should be all of our goals this session, and appreciate that this bill is part of that conversation. Are there any other members that have any questions? If not, I will turn it back to Representative Hausman to move your bill, or to renew your motion, rather.
I will renew my motion that House File 2880, forgot the number for a moment, be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Ms. Hirsch, please take the roll on final passage of House File 2880 as amended.
Chair Hausman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Howard?
Aye.
Representative Tice is excused. Representative Agbaje is also excused. Representative Bliss?
No.
Representative Gomez?
Gomez, aye.
Representative Hassan? Representative Heinrich?
No.
Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Juergens?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Breyer?
Aye.
There are 6 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 6 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to taxes. Thank you again to all the testifiers and to Chair Hausman. Members, our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 22nd. There being no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.